Jesus? Who didn't quite catch it before? Die Leute, die können Deutsch sprechen, bitte, bitte, bitte sagen nichts, okay? Danke, sagen nichts, okay? Even if you speak a little, sagen nichts, bitte, danke. Okay, so we're going to begin. O du eselhafte Martin, o du martinischer Esel, du bist so fahl als wie ein Gall, der weder Kopf noch Kragen hat. Mit dir ist gar nichts anzufangen, ich seh dich noch am Galgen hangen. Du dummer Paul, halt du nur's Maul, ich scheiß dir aufs Mal, so hoff ich, wirst doch erwachen. O lieber Lippel, ich bitte dich recht schön. O leck mich doch geschwind im Arsch, o leck, leck mich doch geschwind im Arsch. O lieber Freund, verzeihe mir, den Arsch petschier ich dir, Lippel, Martin, Lippel, verzeihe mir.
Yeah, good recitation, Tim. So what I want to know what people thought about that, even, and I mean, I don't want German speakers to say anything. Just be quiet. But you know, anybody who just basically what did people think about the you know what they heard, even though you couldn't understand, you know, the words. What did people think? Anybody have like what did people think it was probably about? Any ideas?
Marty heard love.
I'm not talking, don't, I'm saying don't mention any of the words. I'm saying if you know some of the words, don't mention any of the words. But based on the way that it was spoken, I mean, what did people, okay, romantic. Yeah, it did. The passion in the reading? Yeah, there was passion, yeah. Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of a goodbye.
Like sentimental, kind of sappy.
Yeah,
oh, I'm going to miss you.
It reminded me of a young plant.
All right. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That's it. The thing is, keep all these comments and thoughts in mind, and we'll come back to this. But I want to say a few things. And you know, I just wanted to make the point. You know, why is it that we're studying music? And if people have been around the campaign, like on the field, or have been around the office recently, you've noticed that we've been actually singing a lot of music, and especially out. We've been using it more on the field more than we did before since we had this convention in Boston, where basically we took over all parts of the city and, yeah, the entirety of the Democratic Party, like in one small area of the city, kind of, I mean, of the whole National Democratic Party. And if you actually maybe get at what's the purpose, you know, of the music, a lot of people might say, well, it's to bring beauty, right? We want to bring beauty to the population where currently that's lacking. There's an absence of beauty. You know, maybe people are going through, like, mundane activity kind of in like, a routine. And they don't actually think outside of, like, you know, kind of a linear way of, I go from point A to point B. But I don't really think about anything outside of what's you know, comfortable to me. Some people actually might go out there with the idea that we want to get together, you know, big chorus and just like, you know, revolution through chorus. We're just going to go out. We're going to bring down the walls of the city. We're going to, you know, our enemies are going to be destroyed by our just booming voices, you know, or like, so we're going to sing loud and fast. And maybe people like conception of what we're doing is, well, this is, you know, what's going on with these people singing on our campus all the time? It seems like this is just like the artsy fartsy thing that hasn't been done. So, you know, it's just like the same thing as like, you know, white on white. Now it's, you know, singing in the streets. And this is like the new form of art that, you know, that hasn't been done. But let's take the first. I think a lot of people kind of go with the first idea that music is probably most likely to bring beauty to the population. But, you know, I really want to challenge that, even just that idea, you know, just bring beauty. Because if you look at, I took an example of a type of animal like a nightingale, which can also produce a type of beautiful, sweet sound that you will find pleasant to the ear. You want to hear it. And, you know, it's lacking in that it hasn't been actually technically trained, right? You know, the nightingale didn't take voice lessons. And it doesn't know anything about the intervals that it's using to sing, right? And so you couldn't, like, say, you know, hey, what key are you singing in? You know, you can ask. That was a lovely piece. Can you sing that one again? You know, it doesn't have any awareness about what it's doing. So the thing is, even other animals find it pleasing, right? I mean, like your cat likes hearing, you know, they like watching TV with you, or dogs, and or a bird, right? You like, you know, its attention is caught and it's kind of, right, it's focusing on this sound, and it's pleasant, and it's coming from another animal. You know, we ourselves as human beings and other animals also share in that we find this pleasing, this type of sound that's being made. So, I mean, really the question is, what's the difference? You know, what's the difference between, you know, the beautiful sound that might come from an animal and, you know, the sound that human beings are able to produce, the music that human beings are able to produce. And, you know, the nightingale is endowed with an ability to sing. So are human beings. It is natural, contrary to what people might believe, every single person born can actually sing. And also, we can actually create instruments. We can go beyond just being able to sing using, you know, what we were endowed with, but also we can go beyond and we can create imitations of our voice, the violin, string instruments, brass, woodwinds. So we can actually build up more of a level of skill. You know, we can actually improve on what we're doing. We can make things more complicated. And so my nightingale's just stuck. You know, it's going to be chirping throughout its whole life and for many thousands of years to come. So one might say that on the one hand, you have the nightingale producing a sound based on, well, which is nature, which is natural, comes through nature. And on the other hand, what the human being is doing is something which is produced through reason, right? Something that we actually produce art. And art is that which is produced through reason. And that, you know, so music being one form of art, we actually can apply reason to improve it. We can actually apply science to improve music. But what if that which we are producing, you know, musically, is done so by imitation, right? Say, like, we're not applying science. We're imitating, right? Like human beings, we do that, right? Is that still going to be art? Is that still called art? You know, is there anything scientific about it? Because every single one of us has gone to a musical performance, and you leave and you're walking around and you're humming the tune. and you're imitating what you just heard. And you might not even notice you're doing it. But the funny thing is that, have you ever seen those dogs that bark jingle bells? It sounds really off key, but they do it. Like it sounds, you could recognize the tune jingle. But more specifically, you have parrots, which they do a good job. They actually, there's some that are pretty good, and they can mimic, you know, human voices, and they can sing songs. So the thing is, what we can do, they can do. We can imitate what we've just heard, you know. So can animals. So if music is produced through reason, because being one of the arts, art being that which is produced through reason, and its reason is that which the beast is without, then the act of imitating, which human beings often do, is not art. So from that standpoint, if we're singing a canon, for example, or anything, and we know it by memory, or we've just heard it a lot, so we just picked it up. And even if the intention of the composer was something perhaps profound, or maybe if there was a certain meaning that they intended, they perhaps put a lot of thought into what they wrote. If the performance of that piece is done through imitation, then just singing that piece does not separate us from animals. Because if you think about it, even beasts have memory. Like birds, they migrate. And so they have a certain memory, you know, which might allow them to actually go back to where they came from, or your dog has a memory, and your dog gets lost. And then, something can happen to your pet, but it flies back or it makes its way back. It has a certain amount of memory. So being able to just, you know, quickly pick up something, you know, hum a tune, or like the thing that I was thinking about is like you have certain people who like play like electric guitar, and they do like these guitar licks, and they're like super fast, and they're like Metallica, and I'm going to go as fast as I can, you know, that shows how great of a guitarist I am. And, that's not art. Because if you think about it, you know, if art is produced through reason, if it is scientific, then you can have an individual who might have the ability to build up, you know, a certain amount of skill, like physical ability, like somebody who plays electric guitar. You can probably do some pretty interesting things with your voice. You could, you know, that maybe you build up a skill to do that. But you can have another person who cannot do that, who has not built up that ability through, you know, that practice, or maybe they're not capable of, but has much more of an understanding of science, a higher knowledge of science that could be applied to the development of musical composition. And which would be the quality that would separate us from what the animal can do. Because, you know, they can do some pretty interesting things, you know, if you train them to. So what you're singing or what you're playing could have nothing to do with what was really intended, like what a composer wanted to communicate through the piece of music. You know, especially if for instance, you're singing a song in a different language and you have no idea or you may have heard the translation, but you forgot, or you just know the idea generally, but you don't know, like, what the meaning is of a specific word that you're singing. And so right now, what I want to do is go back to the poem that Tim recited in German. And everybody remember all the things that you said about it, and that you thought about it. And now what we're going to have, he wants to reread it, and then Brendan's going to give the English translation. So And just keep in mind what I'm saying here, because what I mean by, you know, there's actually, what I'm getting at is there actually a necessity to understanding what is being said in order to communicate the idea through music. So I'm going to have, you know, Tim reread that.
And everyone in this room is capable of pronouncing the words just as well as I, and imitating the style as well. In fact, hopefully, Brendan will imitate my style in reading the English translation. All right. Just let the words just sort of come into your ears. They're nice. O du eselhafte Martin, o du martinische Esel, du bist so fahl als wie ein Gall, der weder Kopf noch Kragen hat. Mit dir ist gar nichts anzufangen, ich sehe dich noch am Galgen hangen. Du dummer Paul, halt du nur's mal, ich scheich dir auf mal, so hoff ich wirst doch erwachen. O lieber Lippel, ich bitte dich recht schön, o leck mich doch geschwind im Arsch, o leck, o leck, o leck mich doch geschwind im Arsch. O lieber Freund, verzeih mir, den Arsch petschier ich dir, Lippel, Martin, Lippel, verzeih mir.
Oh, you ass like Martin. Oh, you Martin like ass. You are as good for nothing as a Frenchman who possesses neither a collar nor a head. With you is absolutely nothing to be started. I see you hanging from the gallows still. You stupid Paul, just hold your mouth. I'll shit in your mouth, so I hope you'll get up. Oh, my dear Lippel, I'll ask you rather nicely. Oh, lick me in the ass. Oh, lick, oh, lick, oh, lick me quickly in the ass. Oh, dear friend, pardon me, the ass I request of you. Lippel, Martin, Lippel, pardon me.
Oh, pardon me.
That was Mozart, by the way.
That was Mozart. It was an X-rated canon, right? Oh, it was a joke for his friends. Okay, so don't memorize that poem. Anyway, so okay. I'm going to be going through the idea of, like, the organizational principle to the universe to give people a sense of maybe, you know, what we're leading to. But what we're going to do right now is investigate a concept that was discovered by Vronadsky and basically completed by LaRouche, and how it directly relates to the music work that we're doing. And we're going to be demonstrating how that relates later on in the panel. But Vronadsky, I don't know, most people, new people don't know, members should know, but he was a biogeochemist. And the idea of a biogeochemist is that you're actually studying the totality of life. Because biology, you're studying life, right? But usually, I don't know, you come across a lot of the biologists in school or biology majors, and they're studying these, like, microorganisms and how, I don't know what they're doing, how they're mutating, and things like that. But how are you going to be able to develop a conception of what's actually guiding that growth, or what's guiding the universal concept of life? And so he ultimately became a biogeochemist with the idea of studying the totality of not human life, but of life in general, and studying the hierarchical relationships of how it was actually organized. So, in a sense, when man or human society emerged onto Earth, we basically intervened with our creative potential to be able to organize the universe in a more effective, more beneficial way, right? Because it was our actual creative potential, our creative reason that intervened and was able to guide the development and the progress. Yeah.
What distinguishes a biogeochemist from the ecologist?
We can take that up after this, because that's a pretty extensive discussion. But we can. You should ask that after we're done. Good. So in a sense, through what Vernadsky is saying is through our labor, through our consciousness of what's happening in the universe, as we become more conscious of what's happening in the universe, we're actually able to transform the Earth into a constant transition into the noetic principle, which is our human cognitive ability. So I think right now we're going to investigate a little bit how we assume how the universe is organized. So I'm going to pass. They could have been bigger, but I just thought I'd save paper and make smaller circles. So I should pass these circles around if people can help me. But we're just gonna investigate our assumptions into how the universe is organized. And that this pedagogical, we're going to be going through, okay, well, what do you think comes first, the point, the line, or the circle? And for those of you that know, keep quiet. Just let people that don't know have a true hypothesis into what they're doing. Anybody that doesn't know, have any idea, what do you guys think? What comes first, the point, the line, or the circle? What do you think, Hector? Have you done this before? Okay. You say the point? Who else says the point? Okay. You know? Okay. Well, I'll let you think about that for a second. I'm going to go into this other idea of the quadrature of the circle. Because if you have... Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Pretty much? Okay. So if you have... hold on. Where's the eraser? If you have polygons inscribed inside a circle, something like square... Now, who thinks that if you actually created more sides to the polygon, that you would become the circle? Eventually, you'd just become the circle. Oh. Yeah? Devil's advocate.
Wouldn't you get infinitely closer but never actually be the circle?
You can try it. Try it and let me know what transpired. But I mean, if you really think about it, it's kind of paradoxical, because as you create more sides, you're getting further and further away from the actual circle. So they're two completely different species. Kind of like, I don't know how your anthropology that teaches you that human beings evolved from apes. But, you know, there's a certain distinction. We're qualitatively different than animals. We'll never be able to create as many sides to be able to just morph into a circle, just like we were never able to morph from an ape into a human being. So that, okay, let's go back now to the idea of the point, the line, and the circle. So, I mean, do people here know what this is, or? Okay, so people that don't. What I want you to do, what I want you to do is fold the circle in half. Okay, what happened? Huh? Speak up. It turned into a taco. I don't think that's the direction I would take it. two equal sides. What did you create out of that action of folding the line in circle? What was the result of that folding? A line. Somebody said it. I think it was Yuka or somebody else. Okay, you created a line, right? Now, what I want you to do is fold it again perpendicular to the line that you just created. I heard an oh my gosh. That's what I like to hear. What did you create? A coffee filter. Pavel. Not quite. Okay, so what did you create? A point, right? So the idea that you can create a circle out of a series of infinite points, you know, hopefully you're on a curved surface of some sort, or a line that just keeps going around. We made an assumption about how the universe is organized. You know, we went from our assumption that, okay, well, maybe we can create a circle out of a line. But you've, in a sense, just demonstrated an organizational principle of the universe, that it is actually from the highest principle, not to the lowest principle, but it's organized in that way. So if we go back to the idea of Vernadsky, who actually discovered that the universe is interrelated with three phase spaces. We're interacting in three phase spaces here. With the abiotic, meaning, you know, rocks, quartz, whatever dead substances, non-living, or interrelated with the biotic, which is like, you know, water, the ocean, even plant life. And then you have the noetic. So you have these three phase spaces that are interrelated, that are interacting at one time, but that are organized by the noetic principle. You're never going to get the biotic from the abiotic. That's unnatural to what the creator intended. So just keep in mind what you just discovered now with the pedagogical and the, you know, the point, the line, and the circle, and how you'll never be able to get a circle from the polygons, but you have the ability to create the polygons from the circle. So it kind of jolts your assumptions a little bit. But also, I mean, don't think about these ideas, especially from Vernadsky, as these nice objective ideas. Oh, you know, he discovered the three interrelated phase spaces. But actually begin to investigate into how this concept actually relates to everything that we do, even in the music. And this is why, you know, you'll come to know why we're actually using this conception to launch this panel, I guess you could say. But you want to begin to establish in your minds this idea of how a universal principle that basically it's a principle that relates with every truthful concept, right? Every truthful concept that you come across, this will relate to it, this idea, this conception. So just keep that in mind. So, you know, going back to the idea of the three interacting phase spaces, the abiotic, the biotic, the noetic, what we're going to go through now is we're going to expose this relationship in music. Basically, metaphorically in music, you have the abiotic would be like a violin or a keyboard or a piano, cello, dead instruments, right? And then the biotic would be the human singing voice, which we're going to be going through these and elaborating on these concepts a lot more. And then you have the noetic, being the human creative intervention or our human creative potential. Actually, we'll get to that. That question will be answered in the later section. But, okay, here's mine.
So, music is obviously a big part of this campaign, and what I want to do quickly is take some of the mystery out of this music. What is usually overlooked is, you know, where does this scale come from? you know that all instruments have like these holes. If it's a woodwind or something like that, it has a hole, and you're like, you know that each hole or the combination of holes being closed and open is going to produce different notes. Or the strings, you see stringed instruments, depending on where you put your finger, you're going to produce different notes. But how do we even, but where to, what actually organized our choices of notes? Right? Maybe you never thought about it. Maybe it's always been on your mind. But we got to unravel this as a physical phenomenon, right? Music is accessible to us in that way. A real physical phenomenon that is not tangible. We can't open it up and look at it or something like that. Or so we have a very interesting problem to look at. From what we know, the scale, the musical scale, the do, re, mi, the solfège that we are often singing, you have basically seven notes that you're singing. And then the eighth, the octave, is twice that of the first. But of all possible notes to sing, why these seven? You know, is there some kind of order to it? Is it just Western music, you know? And from what I know, this kind of science goes back to the Greeks, and it's often attributed to Pythagoras as someone who was an early investigator into the scale. And for him, and others probably before, there were certain things that could be quickly observed, such as with the open string. If you were to sound the string, of course you'd have to have some kind of tension. But if you sound that string and try to, you know, take different, move your finger along the string while sounding it, you're going to notice a change, right? And what was discovered right away was that if you move to halfway between half of the string, you're going to produce a sound that's very, it strikes a similar sound to the open string. This it's not the same note, obviously, but it has this consonance. I'll try to demonstrate it on the piano. If this were my open string, and then I cut it halfway, right? That's different. That relationship is quite different than any other cut that I would make. You have kind of an inversion here. Now, because Pythagoras and his school were philosophers and mathematicians, there has to be some kind of order to our choices in the division of the string. But you have to have some way of communicating it to someone else. You might write a little ditty on your one-string instrument or your two-string instrument. You're like, this is fat. And you're playing it. But you would have no way of teaching it to someone else. They wouldn't know where to put their fingers, right? You have to have some kind of reason of dividing the string and communicating these intervals. So they like it. So the ancient Greeks. What's that?
Can't you learn it by ear? I mean, if you hear a melody, you pick it up back just like that.
Yeah, truly. But that's what Lamarri was saying, that the animal can do this as well, right? The animal can imitate, and we can imitate. You can probably play the Fifth Symphony on your kazoo, you know, right? And but does that mean that you speak the language of music? Does that mean you compose? Does that mean that you've created something with the music? So what we want to do is kind of, if we hear different intervals and we hear consonants and dissonance, we want to know what is the cause. And what does knowing more about music teach us about ourselves and about the rest of the universe? You know, a real science. So I'm going to try to get through this as quickly as possible. But I'll kind of develop what these intervals are. And I'll be sparing. Okay. So So dividing the string is essentially likened to dividing the circumference of a circle. Like if I needed to cut the string in half, that would be like, you know, geometrically finding a way to divide the perimeter of the circle into two parts. So if I made my cut here, I could open up that string, and there's my halfway point. So we have a ratio of one to two, right? I'm sounding half the string. But what did that do to the sound? What it actually did to the sound is it actually made twice the rapidity, the motion. You're actually doubling the pitch, right? So you have an interesting relationship there. You have to keep these things separate. You have the amount of string that you're sounding, but then you have the pitch that you're hearing, right? Okay, so what's the next division, right? You could take, you know, a fourth, an eighth, and so on. Why, this kind of division, right? Fourth, eighth, okay. But that's essentially the same relationship. You're looking at the difference between one and two, and then the difference between, you know, well, they're all the same. They're all the same division. So if I did find the fourth or the eighth, what do you think is going to happen? Who has a hypothesis? Yeah. So I have a certain distance here. But what if I take half of it again? Half of this pitch. Say this were a new string of half the size, and I cut that in half. And again. So you're getting octaves. This is what they would call an octave. So we need to find some new proportion beside the relationship between one and two and that again, one and two, one and two. The next one would be, you know, in our natural number series, would be the difference between two and three, which would be likened to dividing the circle into three equal parts. And that would sound two-thirds of the string. But what would that do to the sound? Obviously, if I get that cut, it's going to be less than the octave, isn't it? If cutting it halfway gives you the octave, if I'm sounding more of the string, right, then it's closer to the whole string, it's going to have to be lower. So it's not by two. It's more than one, but less than two. And what was hypothesized was that this proportion, this inverse proportion, was being held. That you're actually augmenting the sound by a proportion of three to two, which we call one and a half. One and a half times the original tone. Then the other divisions quickly follow. You want to look at 3 to 4 and 4 to 5, right? Because these were all constructible by the geometers. Okay. And you're going to increase the sound here by 1.5, here by 1 1/3, and here by 1 1/4. Now, there are other intervals in between. But what would be the next one? A six-sided polygon, right? And you would hold down one-sixth of it. 5/6 sounding. And you're going to get 6/5, right, or 1 1/5. And what would you do next? What's the next polygon? Or what's the next division of the string? Seven. But is seven constructible? So that may be a sound, but it clearly wouldn't be consonant with in this way. Since seven is not constructible, that was thought to be the reason, that was thought to be the cause of its dissonance relative to the other divisions of the string. So you have something interesting here. Of all possible divisions, this is the key. Of all possible divisions of a string, as you sound these against the other, you know, maybe a fifth and a third. It's very common, right? Is your tonic note? The third? Recognize it? Okay, so why is it that these are sharing a consonant? It seems to be coming from some underlying principle that's not seen in the music. It comes from the geometry. But that if I take a, some proportion that is not coherent with geometry, I'm going to get a dissonance. So you have to wonder about that. You have to wonder about this, this ordering principle. Which is subordinate to which? You know, whose idea was it to have music, well, harmonies work in this way? And just to take some of the mystery out, this there were intervals in between here, but what they called this one was the fifth, the fourth, the third, and the minor third. If you take another portion of the fifth, if you sound three fifths, you're going to get five thirds, which they call the sixth, right? Because that would fall between here and here. And then there's also the major seventh. There's other intervals, but they name them basically in the order in which they come, from lowest to highest. And that's kind of how. That's pretty much what we know about the original proportions of the string. Now you have problems with tuning in that, but I'm not going to go into that to spare, so that we actually get the substance of this discussion. One of the interesting things that will now happen is that what if I take my string? See, here's my tonic note. Here's the octave, right? The halfway point, the double octave. What if I wanted to move beyond just this with the octave? What if I took a proportion which was two-thirds? And then I wanted to add another proportion of two-thirds. Right? Add two-thirds to two-thirds. What would that create? You'd obviously be moving past the octave, right? So, if you take this interval, the sound now, the frequency of three-halves times three-halves, you get 9/4. Right? But what happens if you divide that by two? You get 9/8. But I cut that in half, like take the lower octave, right? I've created a new note by using some lawful measure of the string and repeating it. Now if I get the 9/8, I mean I get the 9/4, but if I cut that in half, I can find its lower octave, supposedly. And that would be a proportion of 9/8 in this way. Well, there's another interesting that happens which validates this this step. By taking a fifth, which is two-thirds of the string, and going another two-thirds of the string. Two-thirds of this portion right here. This would be like the total string. Like if this was the, this would be the, you know, the, what do you call it, the bridge. And this would be like the head of the instrument. So the total string between this octave, I took two-thirds here, and then added another two-thirds. The frequency produced would be, you're looking at three halves, and then acting upon the three halves by another three halves. You don't simply add them, but as because these are proportions, right? And you're gonna get 9/4, which exceeds. See, 9/4 exceeds 2. If this is 1 and this is your octave at 2, you're exceeding 2. This would be 1. This would be 2 1/4. But if you drop, if you cut this in half, you're dropping down to the octave, would fall here. And that, so this gap here, by this proportion, by this calculation, it should be 9/8. Right? Now, if I go up a fifth again, and then I drop back a fourth, I want to divide out of the fifth. I want to remove the interval that we call the fourth. So if the fifth was here and the fourth was here, I want to kind of slide back by a fourth, which we said was a proportion of 4/3. So to divide it out, I multiply by the reciprocal, I get 9/8. So by a different method of construction, I got the same interval. We got a basic step here, which is 9/8. Right? Okay. So we can begin. We won't be able to speak in this musically about like counting numbers necessarily. It's not like 1 1/4 or 1 1.875, anything like that. But everything has to be a proportion. Like if you move by a third and you want to move by another third, you're not just going to simply add them. They can't be like stepwise. It has to be like a proportion, because you're dealing with what's remaining after having moved the third. You're dealing with what's remaining. So now you have to take that as your new basis of measure. So this is all in proportion. Now, an interesting thing happens if you're looking at music in this way. If we take this 9/8, and we want to know how many of these basic steps will fit between the tonic note and say the major third, let's see what happens. I want to take the third.
What do you mean, how many basic steps?
Like, can I go 9/8 and then 9/8 again? And then go 9/8 again? And by moving in this kind of arithmetical way, like just keeping with the same proportion, will it coincide with one of these proportions? Is it going to fit tightly together? Like there's two whole steps in a third, that kind of thing. So we'll look at it. Here's our third. Let's take 9/8. And let's take 9/8 again. So there's a proportion that would be two whole steps. But if we try to if we want to divide out, let's see the best way to do it. I don't want to give it an arithmetic. I just want to stick with the proportions. Yeah. Well, I did it two ways. The first way was by moving by 2/5 and cutting it in half. 2/3, right. See, it's hard. It takes a lot of patience. You have to think about the difference between the amount of the string you're sounding and the pitch that's sounding. The pitch is always going to be the reciprocal. So what I call 3/2 is a 1/5 in sound. So we take 3/2 and 3/2. That should get us the octave of our whole set. But if you go up a 1/5 and down a 1/4, right, we have these two very different proportions. One was found as a relationship between 2 and 3, and the next between 3 and 4. I said, okay, but I want to know the space between them. You know, how much is this? That what's the proportion that comes in between those two proportions? So what you can do is take your 5/4 and divide out this amount, right? To see what's left. If they were congruent, then they would equal 1, right? But you know the answer? I don't think I have the answer, but I know that well, actually, I don't know if I've done this one. Let me hold on.
80 over 81.
Really? You got it done? Yeah, you get 80 over 81. Very close. We wanted 81 over 81 or 80 over 80. It's extremely close. There's other ways of calculating this gap. In fact, if I move between the octaves by thirds, if I try to take 3/3, again, it gets very, very close to completing the octave. Extremely close, even closer than the 80 over 81.
Can you even hear that?
I don't know. I mean, you can. Well, that's an interesting question, because, I mean, how would you produce these frequencies? Yeah, a slight movement in the finger changes it. Yeah. But the thing is, the change is so subtle, but it's going to keep haunting you. Anytime you try to proportion these out stepwise, say, well, I want to know how many of these fit in this and how many of these fit in this, it's going to haunt you. There's only certain ones, there's only certain relationships that will be congruent, but a lot of them will not. And so what we're looking at here now is a physical principle. So you have to keep these things straight. You have the music, the harmonies, I guess, they seem to be based on some principle of geometry. But yet, it also wants to slightly diverge from the geometry. It won't close up proportionally. It won't close up the way you would want it to. You say, why is it diverging? Well, this gap in the scale is what Pythagoras referred to as a comma. And it's there as a consequence of the fact that that music, at least in this universe, is non-uniform. It's non-uniform. It's there's some physical principle acting on the string or acting on a manifold of other things. But our interaction with music, you kind of have to, you know, when we interact with music in this way, it's, like I said, it's always going to haunt you. And the only thing you can say about it, you wouldn't want to do what the academics have done with this the history of this investigation, which is try to disperse that tiny gap and spread it out amongst the intervals. Say, well, we're going to just cheat these a little. I'm gonna make the fist a little bit flat. I'm going to make the fourths a little bit sharp. I'm going to make the thirds a little bit sharp, but less sharp than I made the fourths. And you're going to try to squeeze out by adding and subtracting, and you're going to dismiss the comma altogether and make it uniform. That's what you don't want to do, because what are you missing? You're missing the fact that this comma is there as a consequence of a physical principle. There's some universality, there's some universal concrete action that's always governing music, right? Now, this is not only the case in our own domain with our instruments and with our voices. What you have is, imagine what if I plucked a string on my guitar, I took my stringed instrument and plucked the string, but it took 1 year to make one rotation, right? Yeah, you would have to be really patient. But, yeah, if it took 1 year to make one revolution, okay, what if I plucked another string and it took 1.5 years or 2 years to make a revolution?
Are you saying vibration?
One complete rotation. Like when the string is vibrating, you know, it's not simply wiggling back and forth, but it's making some kind of elliptical path. It's making a revolution. And the rapidity of that motion is going to determine the pitch you hear. If it does many in an interval of time, you're going to hear it. But if it takes a year, you probably aren't going to hear it. There are tones. There are pitches that are out of the domain of the human ear. We know that. So, but in being a revolution of 1 year against 1.5 years, or 1 year and 9/10 of a year, does that mean that these principles of music are no longer applicable? Or wouldn't the scientific thinker rather say, well, even though I can't hear these intervals, they are intervals. There is some kind of harmony. And this was Kepler's hypothesis. He had hypothesized that the differences between the orbits of the planets, that the reason they were spaced apart the way they were, I mean, of all possible spacings, why these? I mean, he first had hypothesized that they were, it was being guided by geometry, that there was a certain nesting of the Platonic solids, the only possible regular solids being nested inside of one another, and the different, like if each one of these solids had a sphere around it, the radius from the center of that solid to the sphere or to the edge of the solid, the polyhedra, you have these two different magnitudes, but between solids and their respective spheres, you would generate a whole series of relationships which match up very, very closely to the actual orbits that are observed. The way that these proportions from geometry are very, very close, but not exact, right? And so then he said, well, wait a minute. From what I know about music, maybe what's happening in the solar system is that there's some kind of harmony of the worlds, that they're actually in harmony with one another. And he had hypothesized that based on this music, which is much deeper than I presented, that there also had to have been some kind of dissonance in the solar system. And he had hypothesized exactly where the dissonance would occur. He said there must be some unstable orbit between Mars and Jupiter. There's a huge gap there. And he was not able to validate that in his lifetime. It was a hypothesis. Only after Carl Gauss had correctly identified the trajectory of an unknown object in space, which turned what we call which was called Ceres, right? Only having gone through this investigation of another phenomenon did we discover that there indeed was an asteroid belt exactly where Kepler had hypothesized it to be. So Kepler didn't have to have a telescope and look at asteroids in order to know something about the universe. This was a unique power of the human mind, right? And so you have a paradox that is, you know, that is found in harmony itself. What I'd like to do is demonstrate this gap as best as we can with Mihua's help. What we'd like to do is sing a scale, the solfège that we're all so familiar with. But what we're going to do is we're going to change the direction. Together we'll ascend, but I'm going to hold the fourth note, the fa. She's going to complete the scale and come back down to the fa. So there's going to be a change in direction. The fa that I'll be sounding will be of an ascending, and her fa that she will hold will be a descending. We're going to sing in unison in the same octave, and she's going to go all the way up and then come back down to where I'm holding. Up and then back down. We'll see. Let's see if we can find this phenomenon.
Do re mi fa.
Let's do it again. They remember it. Oh, okay. You want to do it? Two guys? Well, hold on. We'll just try again. We've done this before in practice. We've got to remember that if we're right about this gap, right, it is a very subtle gap. Someone asked if they could hear it. The problem is that the human mind overcomes this gap. You naturally want to sing in unison with people. So, but we're going to try again. Well, there would be a slight conflict. There should be a slight conflict. Hold on. Ready? We go a little faster, too. And.
Do, re, mi, fa.
Okay. So it's very slight, but it's there. So a change in direction actually changed the interval that we were singing. Right?
It's a good question.
But of course, as in the first case, I mean, the human mind has also the power to overcome that. Right? So you have an interesting thing that the human mind does is that even though there are certain consequences that happen in music from the division of the string, the human mind is able to compensate for that because what your voice is doing is being organized on the same principles that the universe itself is organized on. And so that needs to be investigated. And just to close up this section, one of the great things about studying music and why it's important is because here you have a paradox, but this is a physical phenomenon. It's a real paradox. It's not like a sophist argument, like which came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, there's not a whole lot to learn from contemplating that paradox, right? Or there's another clever one that was in Plato. He said, "Is that which is not? Does that which is not exist? Can that which is not exist? But by referring to it, apparently it exists. But the condition of its existence is that it does not exist." Okay. There's a huge difference between asking these kind of questions and investigating the Pythagorean comma. and how the human mind is able to make discoveries such as Kepler's when he wasn't actually there and didn't have anything to see. There is a virtue in knowing the difference between these paradoxes. So we'll move on and look at this characteristic of the human singing voice overcoming the comma.
Okay, so we've been dealing with this idea of classical, right? So what the hell is classical? Do any of us really know what classical is? I mean, we talk about a classical humanist education. We talk about classical music, classical drama, classical. But it's like, okay, well, does that mean that I have this checklist of things that I can't listen to? Like, I can't listen to Wagner. No, I can't listen to Wagner. But you don't really know why. You don't really know why your mind actually rejects what Wagner's created. You don't know what that element is to be able to, I guess, comprehend and make it intelligible. So, yeah, well, what is this idea of classical? What is a classical method? And so we've been having pretty good discussions in our groups. And I kind of made a discovery in the idea that the idea of classical means it's relevant in all time. I mean, you have, okay, well, I mean, obviously it's still an idea we're working through. We're still having discussions on it, and we invite people to participate in it. But for instance, if you take a contemporary poem, or a contemporary drama or a contemporary piece of music, there may be relevant emotions that you relate to. There may be, you know, there may be emotions conveyed, but there's really no universal historical significance. Like there's to the actual thought objects. Because you hear a lot of these guys today, and they're speaking to a certain emotion. You're getting attracted to it because you feel them going through, I guess, the same thing that you are. But they're usually specific to the author or the composer or the poet in the sense that, I mean, basically there's an actual idea or absence of an idea of the simultaneity of eternity, where you actually have these classical concepts that are relevant in all of time, really, because there's no time in a classical concept. So I guess the point being that you have this disjunct quality, you have this absence of motion, where, you know, these contemporary pieces of music or poetry or whatnot, they're basically coming, they have this absence of coming from somewhere with an intention and then also moving forward with an intention to change, to improve something, to allow for it to be worked on by future minds. So I mean, we can play around more with this idea of classical. Think about it, because it's not something you'll just understand immediately. But we're going to investigate this idea of the human singing voice. Everybody has a voice. Every human being has a voice. We may not like what we hear sometimes, you know, even members. Sometimes we crack and all kinds of stuff. But we're actually physiologically created to communicate ideas. I mean, if you take the case of an animal, right, just any animal, zebra, walrus, I don't know, whatever you like. Basically, everything that they do is a reaction. It's a reaction to a sense experience. You know, they actually can be conditioned to react a certain way to familiar things. You know, they have that element of being able to be conditioned. But if you take the case of humans, every apparatus we have is used to communicate an idea, especially our natural apparatus, our ability to communicate an idea through singing. So, I mean, some humans respond to sensory objects. Like, you have those flashing lights to the strip bar with the flashing arrow or something. Or just whatever. These sensory objects that are just basically
what's the word? That pervade our society. You know, everything that you see on the TV, on the billboards, it's all just speaking to your sensory apparatus. But in principle, the literature, the drama, the poetry, they're avenues for us to begin to actually investigate the physical and metaphysical world that we live in. And then we have the capability of using those discoveries of what we're investigating into to improve, to progress the universe that we live in. No animal has the capability of doing that. You don't have 6 billion hamsters on the face of this planet. You know, you don't have 6 billion bunnies, but you have more than 6 billion people. And if you actually look at the science of history, you begin to understand and or get a conception of how that's actually been possible. And I mean, this whole weekend has been an investigation into how that's actually been possible. So I mean, animals actually have a fixed boundary condition. To the extent that their sensory apparatus triggers something where they just, you know, their mind's gland just responds to something. But they can't go beyond that. They can't go beyond just reacting to what that object was in front of them. You know, maybe they smelled something, maybe they saw something, that a certain color that attracted their eye. But they can't go beyond that. They can't hypothesize and be like, oh, well, I wonder what's creating that effect. You know, let's see if I can figure out what's causing that. But human beings have sensory apparatuses just as animals do. But we have the ability to go above and beyond the capability of any animal, you know, in the sense that to be able to comprehend what's causing that effect. I'm pretty sure if you've been around for a while, somebody's probably talked about the idea of the allegory of the cave, where human beings, Socrates, you know, Plato dialogues, where we have the ability to discover what's generating the shadows that we see. Because everything that we see, everything that, you know, relates to our sense apparatus is a shadow. There's something that's creating that shadow that we have the ability to discover. So, you know, we're presented with these things that attract a response from our sensory apparatus, but just as humans, we have the ability to investigate into what's causing the effects, right? And like I said, animals can't do that. So now if you actually want to look at our natural physiological apparatus and how it works mechanically to communicate an idea, the best way to do it would be to study this idea of bel canto, vocalization. It's a method, you know, a method by which we can actually communicate effectively. Bel canto literally meaning beautiful song. And so if you actually take a look at a couple elements of a natural beauty, basically meaning God-given, I think Tim's going to go into the idea of artistic beauty a little bit later, which comes from our intervention, like our creative intervention into the universe, into being able to create something effective and beneficial. So, you know, we'll go through a couple of basic elements of bel canto. So, okay, I'm going to go through this first. The idea of elevation, where you're actually singing in the mass. Can you hold this up? Huh? Oh. I have my laser. Singing in the mask. Okay. Well, sorry, I just get excited. So basically, you have this conscious placement of the voice in the head, where you're resonating your bones and your sinus cavities right here. So I'm gonna have everybody stand up. We're gonna instead of like just talking about this stuff, everybody's gonna do it. Yeah, it's a sinus resonance. Where, I mean, if you actually think about this, is a resonance analogy. If you take the bone, the hard, hello. Standing up doesn't mean talk. I'm just kidding. So you have the hard sinus bone, and then an analogy to think about or a metaphor would be like a hard violin body. You know, the body of wood. They're all resonating chambers. You know, we just work with a different substance. So basically, what's going to happen is the idea of singing nasally, to be able to make it resonate in the sinus cavities, the bones, everything that's around the eye area. So what we're going to do is just sing a simple no, 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 no. The idea and the purpose of the elevation is that, I mean, to a certain extent, if you could imagine your vocal cords that keep flapping together, eventually, they, like, I don't know, if you're running a lot and your thighs, like, rub together, they hurt after a while. They like, if you can imagine it going on for a while, they could develop calluses, all kinds of stuff. So that's what happens to your vocal cords. They develop calluses. If you don't actually incorporate what your physiological body has the ability and potential to do, which your mind is actually directing your body to do so. Because what, I mean, yeah, right. Animals can't consciously create the sound that we just created. They can't consciously change. You know, maybe sometimes you wake up in the morning and you're singing in your throat. You have the ability to change that, you know, through directing your mind to do so. So did everybody feel a certain resonance in their sinus, in their nose, a little bit shaking? If you didn't, you should try it again. But this is, how many people have been to a rock concert? Okay, well, how many people have seen an opera or a classical music, you know, vocalizing concert? Okay, I can't really tell who raised their hands, but so the idea is, if you've been to a rock concert, you've probably noticed that they have these, you know, 20 gigawatt amplifiers that sit on either side of them, right? They're just amplifiers, and then you look at the singer, and his veins are just popping out, he's sweating, and he's all red. It might be because of the red spotlight, but it's usually not the case. And so your ear just can't hear anything. But, you know, I don't know, if you're drunk or if you're just happy to dance and bump into people, you don't really pay attention. But if you've been to an opera or a concert, a classical vocal concert, you realize that there is no amplification, there's no microphone, there's nothing, there's no amplifier. So what is the capability of that one human being that's standing, you know, somewhat far away from you, to be able to project that sound and be able to get to you and spin around the room and spin around to everybody else? What is that quality that human beings have? And so we're actually, this brings us to the idea of this least action principle, where we have the ability to create the most amount of sound, the most potent booming sound, correctly placed with the least amount of effort. I mean, there's the idea of the flame, pedagogical, where if you place a flame, you really know if you have your hands or your hands on this concept of resonance or bel canto. But if you put a flickering flame in front of your mouth, it's not supposed to be flickering, but just hold it still and just experiment sometime. Start singing. I've done this a couple times and it usually blows it out. But just the way that you actually know you're doing a pretty good job in that it's not expending air is that you're able to resonate it in those sinus cavities. You're able to resonate it in this hard shell that you have, the sinus bones, and things of that sort. So I guess another basic element of bel canto would be the round sound. And we have these five, I don't know if most people have done vocal warm-ups, but we always use these five Italian vowels, U, O, A, E. And the use of the O is actually used to center the entire voice properly. That's why it's usually good to start out, you know, just with no, 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 no. But there's a lot of elements that are incorporated, like the vibrato. We have the natural ability to vibrate our voices. Lamari, can you come up here and demonstrate, like, just a white voice and then vibrate? So just do it without vibrato. I don't think she can do it. It's very hard. Here, I'll do it and then you vibrate. Do you want to try it again? Because you vibrate.
With vibrate?
No, without vibrato. You could hear it at the beginning, right? With no vibrato, and then she just naturally kind of went into it. Okay, now you can go. Right. Yeah, sorry. It's at the top of the second register. But just to give you an idea of how effective the production, what our minds have the ability to do in creating something that engages your mind. Because the first one, you were just like, oh, God, what is that? It just sounds like a Gregorian chant or something. But the second time around with the vibrato, it immediately engages your mind, right? It captures your mind and is like, oh, whoa, what is that? I want to keep hearing this. I want to keep listening to this. Sorry. Okay. No, I don't need the head. So we have a different capacity. There's a different element to the natural beauty of our voice, and that is register shifts. I'm just going to go quickly through this. But Bach thought of the human register shifts as a palette of colors. Right, where every time he composed a piece of music, it wasn't some arbitrary, oh, well, I think I'll just put this note here and this and this and this and this here. But there was a conscious intention to communicate an idea. And we're going to be hearing a lot of these hypotheses after the panel because we're going to have a Musikabend, which everybody is going to stay for. But okay, so we have these palette of colors. In all of human existence, there's only existed six species of human voices, right? We have the soprano, we have the mezzo-soprano, the alto, the tenor, the baritone, and the bass. And we all have our own unique ranges. So you see it here, it's color-coded. So we're just going to take the soprano, right? Color-coded. Most of them have four registers, except the contralto and the baritone and the bass. Okay, so half of them have four registers. But the idea is that, I mean, has anybody tried driving on the freeway in first gear if you drive a stick shift? Okay, only Quincy. Oh, yeah, and Freddie's car. Just kidding. Sorry, I didn't mean to get you in trouble. I already got in trouble. So if you know how to drive a stick shift and you think about you wouldn't even imagine, you would never even want to attempt driving down the freeway in first gear. So why would you ever want to attempt singing, you know, that high C in your chest voice? I mean, I don't know if you'd want to attempt it. It's probably a little bit dangerous, but so our natural physiological body goes through shift changes. When we're singing from our lower register to our higher register, it's elevating. It's becoming higher and higher. And it eventually should be coming out of the top of your head. I haven't discovered that yet, but eventually one day I will. But this idea, I mean, we'll have discussions on this more, which we should, because, you know, to see the relationship between this and how composers use this as a scientific basis to be able to create their compositions, right? Because this directly relates to what they're doing when they have the intention to compose. So, okay, now that we've discovered these concepts like bel canto, register shifts, what do you do with them? You have to do something with it. You can't just discover and be like, okay, well, I guess I'll go do something else. But what is the purpose of discovering these? How do you use them to the benefit of others?
Okay. So, well, it's actually probably very effective to just very briefly demonstrate what the different registers sound like. It's very important. Just maybe does someone want to do it? Who's? Okay. No, it's okay. It's not necessary to make the point. But what I was going to get at is everybody thus far has said that music is a science. And that means you need a scientist to compose music. And what I've been looking at is this idea of, well, LaRouche has talked about how singing comes from the human speaking voice. And to begin to look at, through poetry and other things, how the human speaking voice actually operates. And looking at this from the standpoint of this is how, the author's idea precedes the method the author will use to convey that idea. I'll say that again. The author's idea precedes the method the author will use to convey that idea. And it's also that idea is necessary to have in order for you to recreate the idea as either a singer or a dramatist or whatever it is in classical composition. And I don't know, we're pretty rushed on time. There were some things that Tim's going to go more into that idea. I just wanted to get at some of these. So what are some of these mechanisms that you would use in bel canto composition? Coming from the standpoint of the human speaking voice. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to tell me, I don't know. How old is Amelia Boynton Robinson? No, no, just one person.
I don't know.
How old is Amelia Boynton Robinson?
I don't know.
Do you know, Jen?
I don't
know. Now, does people notice the different ways they said, I don't know? Why did that I don't know make you laugh? So these are the funny things that are not noticeable. You don't think about them in the human speaking voice. But when you're beginning to compose something in which you have an intention to convey idea, you need to take these things into account. And some of the simple methods that people like Shakespeare use. The idea of iambic pentameter. People have heard what that is. Who hasn't heard what iambic pentameter is, or doesn't know what iambic pentameter is, or is not? All right. Okay. Good. So you got just a simple. What's your name? What is it?
Alex.
Alex and Brendan. Can you read this for me? This is first sentence.
Will you go see the order of the course?
Can you do it loud so everybody can hear you?
Will you go see the order of the course?
Okay. Everyone here has said it?
Uh-huh.
All right. Now the way Shakespeare and the way iambic pentameter works is that you have a stress and a non-stress on every other syllable. And it's actually conscious when you're reading. So you would begin with a non-stress, right?
Yeah.
So then you would stress every other one. Two syllables here. Right? And what he means by stress is it isn't like what you had after the election. It's this. he means it from the standpoint of an inflection is a better word. And an inflection is actually with an upward sound. Where in iambic pentameter, you would read it, will you go see the order of the course? And that's very different from, will you go see the order of the course? But you can actually pull out certain words. And the author of Shakespeare would arrange the words he would want on the stress to convey a very specific idea. For instance, what if it was this? Will go you see the order of the course? Now, if you begin to think about it from the standpoint of what follows, Brutus's response to Cassius in Julius Caesar, it won't make as much sense for the counterpoint that Shakespeare is looking at. Will go you see the order of the course? Not I. But if you look at it the way Shakespeare composed it, will you go see the order of the course? Not I.
it has the necessary composition. And you get the counterpoint between the U and the I. Whereas it wouldn't necessarily have that unless Shakespeare had this idea already in mind before he wrote these words. And this is the beginning of what you get with Bach. And you know, there's all sorts of other funny things they use in speech. Is Jack Minahan here? Jack, oh, do you mind if I embarrass you? Okay, you can't hear what I'm saying anyway. No, but it was funny because no, I'll spare him. I'll spare his hit. Okay, no, it's funny. No, but it's okay. But there are, other than inflections, there are things that you use in speech, such as drawn out language. I don't know. But it's also there's a tonality in the way you say things. For instance, Jack was in the bathroom for a long time. And we were trying to do our panel, and people were just slamming on the door. Jack! Jack! There's a line! There's a line, Jack! And he could have just... and he said to Liz, he said, "Liz, you don't know what's going on in my stomach." Oh, that was okay. Najee was pounding, but the response was. Oh, Najee was in the bathroom. Oh, sorry, Jack. Sorry. You've been redeemed. But there, he could have responded many ways. He could have gotten very angry. "You don't know what's going on in my stomach." And it would have had a very different idea. And you get the same thing. You also look at, well, what happens when you end a sentence on an upward inflection? Which in most cases is what? A question, yeah. "Will you go see the order of the course?" What does it need? It needs the resolution. You know, what's that joke that everybody hates? There's two types of people in the world. The ones that finish their sentences. So this is the You're waiting for it, aren't you? So this is the role of the bel canto singing voice, is to, with the different registers, bring out these different inflections. And this is where you get the register shifts you see now are necessary for human beings to convey ideas. And you were built to convey these ideas. And so when you get the people that say, "I can't sing, you know, I don't have a singing voice," you know, they don't ever say, "I can't speak. I don't have a speaking voice." Some people say it. They use sign language. And so this is really how you begin to get a sense of, well, what was the author's original intention? What Tim's going to go through right now is, what is exactly Bach trying to convey to me? You know, other than, you know, the music's nice. You've got, you know, imagine having four, five, sometimes even six voices operating on this type of principle. That's when it becomes fun as a listener. That's when classical composition becomes an art, not just for the composer, but for the listener. You have to begin to order your mind. And so what we've been doing as a part of the campaign is looking at one of Bach's, I guess it's one of his earlier motets. in the middle. One of his a motet that he composed, Jesu meine Freude, which Tim is going to go into some of the aspects and begin to look at how this works in an actual composition composed by a genius.
I need Sky to come up here and set up the laptop. So while he's doing that, I'll just maybe address something that hasn't been discussed very often, but...
Which one do you need?
Just the square.
Is that this one, Sky? Just the square that transformed it? This one on the grid?
Just a simple one. The transformation.
Is that one there?
That's the square.
You're squaring.
The squaring or the square?
Wait, no, just the grid.
Oh, just the grid.
The animation. Okay. Just hold it. Okay. Can you stop it?
So no.
Can we just maybe take that off screen for?
I got it.
Okay. All right. So I'm just going to address maybe a few things that aren't talked about very often. For any of the contacts, have you ever asked yourself, why do these LaRouche people keep singing songs about Jesus? Does anyone in this room feel uncomfortable? I mean, we are in a log cabin with a prayer. Well, I guess to answer the question, I'll pull out the Holy Bible. Actually, that's a joke, because you can't really find the answer in a book. Otherwise, those 58 million people would rather have voted for John Kerry. if you could actually find the answers in a book, God would tell them so. Let's look at this question of the motet. I don't really have an answer for you. You're going to have to maybe just think. And also, I think tomorrow, Harley will do a wonderful job going through this question of Christian fundamentalism, because it is quite valid, right? It is important to understand why exactly, if you took a map of the you know, religious South and placed it, you know, of the Confederacy and placed it over the electoral voting map of the 2004 election, it would frighten you. These people who did vote for George Bush read the same Bible, right, in every motel that. Well, Bach didn't have it in a motel, but, you know, you did have this rich tradition, this rich tradition that, you know, he took to probably the highest level in art. so it's good to really kind of let that uneasiness, because, I mean, the title of the motet is Jesus My Joy, right? Jesu meine Freude. And that might actually invoke within certain members of the audience a certain kind of ill feeling. I mean, what does that mean? Maybe many of us have had bad experiences. I mean, if you ever had a pastor try reading you the Bible, that's generally the part where you fall asleep in church if your parents ever made you go. And it is interesting to look at what Bach did with what's found in the New Testament. You know, the particular motet, Jesus My Joy, is taken from a chapter of Romans, which was, interestingly enough, a letter written to the Romans. And he had some really sharp things to say about, you know, addressing their particular problems that you would encounter if you ever tried organizing a movement in Rome. you'd run into certain blocks, if you will. And, you know, Paul is quite sharp in addressing them. So... You know, Bach took a motet. he took a Lutheran hymn, an old Lutheran hymn that was quite well known. It had a simple, you know, little ditty, a little theme. If someone would like to just sing the soprano line, just the Jesu meine Freude, meines Herzens Weide, just the opening. Just so people have a sense of like what the Yeah, just the first. Just the first. You know, up till Yez Manasseh. So just to give you a sense of what, you know, the tune sounded like. The actual one sung in church was much lower, so. But it sounded like a church song, right? And actually, if you go to certain Lutheran churches, you'll actually find it in the hymnal. So Bach took that, and the verses actually weren't from the Bible. There were about six of them, and Bach transformed. And this is why I actually have this up here, because this is interesting. I was very inspired by the curvature panel. in looking at the motet in this way, but taking a hymn, quite a popular one, well known, and what was Bach's intervention? Because you're moving beyond simply the notes, the sound. You're moving beyond, just going beyond some of the devices that people would tend to associate with music. A trill there. Shift there. But, what in essence was Bach's intervention? Because where does the human mind come in, right? If you look at this creative principle, this noetic principle, because that's really the crowning glory of what we all, had gone through in this panel. From the way the universe is structured, right? From the three phase spaces, from the physical phase space, how it's ordered, then going through your body, a living organism. And then to even some of the poetry, as Brendan went through, really being sort of like the bridge in between that sort of living and the cognitive. Because the poetry, although it is from a human mind, the way you hear it is through the words. And what are words composed of? You actually have like a vowel and consonants that shape physically what's coming out of my mouth into your ears. Of course, doesn't really explain what's generating it, but at least you hear it. And, and some of this stuff, it's really interesting to look at, because even if I was to demonstrate for you a consonant, I'd be cheating. I can't really show you. I mean, did you hear that? that's a B. How about this? That's a P. Did you hear that? No, that's a T. In fact, the only way you can actually hear it is if I go ba. People heard that, right? Ba, da, ta, right? But guess what? There's a schwa. There's a is a vowel. It carries the sound over, right? So, it's quite interesting looking at moving beyond some of these devices, which I have to go through, because they are actually pretty fun to look at how he uses them in the actual composition. But beyond that, looking at, what is the intervention of the mind? What is Bach's mind? How can he take this simple, Jesu meine Freude, right? How can he take that simple tune and transform it into something higher? And so just, looking at some of the geometry of it. Actually, I'll just briefly go through the motet. Not anything long, but just to give you a sense of how to look at it. I'll just sort of summarize the opening and the beginning, because there's actually about 12 different movements. And it's interesting to see how they develop. And they alternate between the original hymn and quotes from St. Paul. But he opens up, Jesus, my joy, my heart's desire, right, my jewel. So you have this idea of Jesus, my joy. So you have a certain conception of joy. And, God's lamb, my bridegroom, apart from you on this earth shall nothing more precious be. Sounds like something you'd sing in church, right? But what does it mean? My joy, my jewel, right? Well, let's take a look at the end. Because you're in a sense looking at a boundary condition. You have like the opening, and then let's take a look at the end. And how does it finish? you know, soften you grieving spirits. Right? Though I suffer here mockery and scorn, nevertheless you remain throughout the suffering as well. Jesus, my joy. So we went from, you know, what you would sing in church, you know, the, you know, my jewel, you know. You just, because if you notice that in modern churches, they just tend to talk about, like, how great Jesus is. And they don't talk about anything else. It's a real lack of thought, right? And what you notice is that you, when you go to the end, you have a certain idea there. And it's not quite that Jesus, my joy, I love Jesus, right? Because you're suffering, you got scorn, you got mockery. You know, there's no bracelet for that, what's written here. But what's interesting is to look at the motet, you know, with, defined within those boundaries, right? And I don't know if I can put back on the square without it moving. Can I just have the square?
Come back.
Okay.
All right. Just the square.
Going back to the old one?
Is there one without the animation?
Okay, well, no, just go back to this one.
Which one?
Yeah. 39.1?
I think it's down here.
Top left corner? Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay, good.
He says, like,
okay. So, think of this. Okay, in your mind, right? In your mind.
I can get it for you. I can get it for you.
But just pause. All right? In your mind, you have a square, right?
I can get it for you.
From one corner. From one corner, you have this notion of Jesus, my joy. Right? So yeah, just put it right here. Jesus, my joy. Right? So just think of these as boundary conditions, right? Jesus, my joy. Right, my jewel, my heart's desire, yay, go Jesus. And then we're going to go to the end, which is suffering, scorn, mockery. You're going to have to be made fun of if you do the right thing. It's going to hurt. But nevertheless, there's a joy. Well, where the heck is the joy coming from? So you have these boundary conditions defined. And so, do the animation.
I just click it, okay? Just click it.
Or the refresh or whatever.
Forward.
Click it. All right, folks. See, you got, you know, SS Noon Me. You got the third movement. Unter. Keep on going. So these are animations, as LaRouche would express. They convey something powerful when they transform, when they move. You can just put it back on the animation and they can move by itself. So yeah, you see a process of transformation. Can you go to the very end?
Very last one.
Yeah, the very last one. Okay. Now that's interesting. Because what, you know, Aaron went through this well, that if you look at it, those two endpoints, those diagonal endpoints, through a process of transformation converge. Now, that's just a visual, sort of metaphor, like a reflection. Of a process that was occurring in Bach's mind, because he does something very interesting through the motet, which is as far out as he takes you from, like, the original melody. If you look at the first piece of music, you just look at the notes, right? And then you look at the very last page, it's the exact same thing. Same music, right? And in fact, the opening words, Jesu meine Freude, meines Herzens Weide. And then you go to the end, and you have Dennoch bleibst du auch im Leiden, Jesu meine Freude. So it begins with Jesus my joy and ends with Jesus my joy. So you have this convergence, you know, on the same notes, the same words. But there's been a process of transformation. And, you know, if people have the desire and we have the CD in someone's car, you know, maybe tonight or sometime tomorrow, people should sit down and listen to it. It's only about 20 minutes. And Bach will take you on a journey from, you know, the beginning to the end. and transform an idea. He'll develop an idea through the music. And the really neat part is in this transformation, there was a singularity. There was a pivot, so to speak, which was the central point. Now, if you look at the motet, you have this arc, right? From the beginning to the end, they're both the same. And the second one and the penultimate one, the second to the last, are kind of the same. And you just have like this arc, right? Well, if you look at the keystone, the one in the very middle, what piece is that? It's a piece we're going to sing for you. And it happens to be that central point. Like geometrically, it's in the center of the motet. And also remarkably, it's the quote from the Bible, which actually has the greatest philosophical significance. So that is so the song we're going to sing, Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, is in fact the philosophical, theological pivot of the entire motet. And if you look at everything that comes before it, it's interesting. It's sort of like it's a certain sort of opinion about joy, about you, God, certain, you know, things you say, like statements, and you can read it as such. I mean, if you look at the actual translation, I mean, it really reads like, you know, you're being told, you know, there's no condemnation, you know, for those who are in Jesus, and, you know, Jesus will cover me, and you know, I've been saved. You know, so you have like this sort of statements, right, set up. But then you have this middle piece, which really makes a hardcore philosophical statement. And thereafter, everything that was said previously, but it becomes tested, right? It becomes, in a sense, validated. It's not just you talking. You're not just saying this principle, that principle, but you actually discover it for yourself when you actually work through the words, when you actually sing it. And the great thing is this motet would be pulled out on special occasions, on special services, and the audience would be, you know, invited to participate in singing the chorales. And so they would actually sing it as if they're going through a certain thinking process, right? And you could actually use motet to educate people and have them relive discoveries made through music. So how do you do that? Well, let's look at this piece. So let's look at the piece we're going to sing for you. It's interesting, because I'll just do something fun. Can you play the tenor line along while we sing it? So yeah, let's just Brendan and I will sing the tenor line, which is the first voice to sort of introduce the idea, the theme, and we're just gonna sing that to the first.
Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich.
Okay. So I don't know if people caught that, but let me play for you the opening. And Bach's having fun to a certain extent, because if you look at the original Lutheran hymn, so let's just play that in reverse. So the original hymn. Musical theme transformed. And then let's actually look at the words he chooses to express the musical idea, because I mean you had these sort of like these words in the beginning in the first measure, and then you hit this high point, and did that stand out, where you had that dun 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 dun, and then you had this kind of like a high point, and then it kind of went off on a run? Did people hear that?
Yeah.
Is anyone not clear on what that is? You want to sing it again? Okay. Yeah, sure.
Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich.
Right, so that dun really stands out, right? Now, well, let's look at the words he chose to inflect, you know, as some of the devices Brendan went through. You have, ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich, right? And in the words, ihr aber, you are but, right? Seid nicht, are not, fleischlich, of the flesh. Sondern, but rather, you know, geistlich, of the spirit, right? So you're not of the flesh, but of the spirit. And, I mean, you just think about that. You know, how a bush-voting Southern Baptist preacher would say that. I mean, what, just from that idea, it's a very short idea. What part of that do you think the Bible-thumping preacher would tend to focus on? What's the most important aspect of what's being said? The flesh. The sinful, wicked flesh. Since Adam, you've all been wicked. I should know. Since Eve, right? Wicked, sinful. You worms, right? If God didn't love you, if God wasn't so great, he'd crush you with his heel because you're not really worthy, but he loves you, so... So... I mean, really have some fun with this, right? Flesh, right? Fornication, homosexuality, right? He would go on and on about it, as they did during the election, right? Gay abortions. Gay abortions. Get out to vote. So you think about what you would tend to focus on. Well, already going off of what Brendan said in terms of like the idea of the author being there present before the device that's actually used, right? Because Bach really pays no mind to the flesh. I mean, you have to say it, right? Because it's right. I mean, as a human being, you're not simply your body, right? It's also good to demystify some of the theology. The words are like 2,000 years old, so people have to think about it a little. And also, it's an old translation. You're not of the flesh, right? Makes, you know, ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, fleischlich. That's all. You're not of the flesh. Sondern, but rather. So he chooses to send your mind to where it should be. But rather, sondern, and then he goes on the run with the Geist, with the Spirit, right? And it's interesting because physiologically, you have the ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich. So you go from you're in the first register, your chest register, right? And you're not of the flesh, and then you go up to that flesh, which is in the, right at the bottom of your second register, and then you drop. Right, so you're almost like to the top of the second. Well, not, I mean the top of the bottom of the second, and then you drop back into the first. But then Bach sends you high to the second, you know, towards the top of the second. Sondern, right, and then he sends you off on the spirit. So, I mean, it's interesting to look at how this plays out, and it's a theme that will be, you know, visited time and time again throughout the piece. And there's more to it. You know, maybe we could. So you're dealing with a certain like geometry, a certain surface, like a manifold, which you have a singularity, this theme, and then let's look at some of the boundaries of it. So I don't know if you could we have the singers come up, the ones that, and I'll experiment with the Okay. So let me.
My pop is just the tenors and then the tenors and altos. But could you play the piano?
Not Danny down there.
Are we gonna go sing over there?
Let's sing in front.
Yeah. So what I'm going to simply introduce to the audience is sort of the beginning theme, and I want Mihwa to actually play along with us, and then we're going to change the geometry, right? We're going to add in another boundary condition. So we're going to add in a second voice, which happens to say the same words, but Bach chooses to place it differently. And we'll see how you have the same idea, so to speak, but it's in a different manifold, and you're going to have a transformation that produces something higher than just the sort of single idea.
So,
well, here, no, we're just doing an experiment, and then we'll sing the whole thing. So, just sing up to the play. Play up till measure 76. Just the tenor, and then we'll add the alto to the tenor.
Okay.
So people can watch an idea. Yeah, up till 76. So, yeah, just the first time, just the tenors.
Okay.
And then the second time, the tenors and the altos. And what you'll find, and your mind will hear a musical idea, a musical theme that employs some of the devices that, you know, were brought up earlier in the panel. And so what's great is to reflect on that idea, and then you really get a kick out of it when you hear it again. But this time it's in a slightly different, it's in a different domain. It's in a different geometry because you've changed the boundary condition, right? You've added another voice, which, you know, if you look at visual space, because this always trips people out about music. You know, it's like with geometry, you know, I can pull out a ruler and a pin and I can, you know, I can like double the square, you know, and show people. It's like there. But with music, it's, you don't really have something to hold on to, right? Where is it? It's, you know, you can even say like in the mask, but it's still vague. It's sort of intangible. So it's relationships that are abstract. It's relationships that are unseen, but still exist. And so if you can kind of just think of like the synthetic geometry, you have like a visual example of you know, relationships, so people can have fun. So in visual space you have directionalities, right? And in musical space you have voices. So let's have a one-dimensional, let's have like a line, so to speak. Yeah. Do a little faster.
Yeah.
Ihr Labe seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich, sondern geistlich. Ihr Labe seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich, sondern geistlich. Ihr Labe nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich. Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich. Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich. Nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich.
Right? So that's Bach's way of telling you you're not of the flesh. Right? And I like that he emphasizes the positive aspects, right? Your the real creative ability of your mind. So then we're going to have the same singularity, the same theme, but we're going to change the geometry. We're going to add another voice. And what you'll find is it's not just saying the same thing twice. Even though they are saying the same thing, roughly. I mean, there might be a few notes here and there that are different, but essentially, you'll really get a kick out of hearing them come in saying what we just said.
But it's not the same thing. So let's try that out.
Am I playing for you?
Yeah.
For the tenors and the alto?
Can you do
it? Oh, you're playing?
Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern That's geometry. It's also beautiful. But there's a reason for it. It's not just that sort of warm feeling inside, but you can lawfully go through it. And hopefully from the presentation, you can take some of the ideas, you know, put forward and just run with them, like the Geist, right? Like the spirit in this particular piece. And that's what people should do with this cadre school. They should take these ideas and run with it. Right? Just run with it. And Bach actually wrote this "but" into the musical piece, right? So you had, I mean, it was a beautiful run, right? It brought your mind up high. And then Bach intervenes with "but." Der aber Christi Geist nicht hat. And it's, you know, it's towards the end of the song, and it just puts the brakes on your first hypothesis, what you were thinking about. And you'll notice, and when we sing the whole thing, you'll notice, like, it just changes. The whole geometry changes. And it becomes a little more serious, right? A little more serious. And there's a little more work involved. Kind of like how we can take the wonderful ideas we get from this cadre school, right? Put forward. But then come Monday morning. But. And you'll hear it in the music, actually. You'll hear it in the music. So I guess we'll... we'll close the panel with singing it. The full translation. The full translation is you're not of the flesh, but rather of the spirit. If otherwise, the spirit of God lives in you all. But, right? But whoever does not have the spirit of Christ, he is not his. So, yeah, you're great, right? Yeah, this mind and noetic powers and all that wonderful stuff. But, you know, if you don't actually embody the principle of Christ, and calm down. I'm not asking you to convert in that way. But, think in terms of principle. Right. Think in terms of principle, because you can't just have the effects. You can't just have the nice ideas and go on and on and on about them. Right. There has to be a certain principle that you possess, that you embody. And so the ending is sort of that sobering reflection on it. And you'll hear it. So.
Can we turn it?
It's fine. Just turn it up. It's not
just going to pick up my voice.
Just turn it up a little bit.
We can't see each other.
Ihr Rabe seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich.
Ihr Rabe seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich.
Ihr Rabe seid nicht fleischlich, fleischlich, sondern geistlich.
Okay, she's asking, is there a schwa in a T and an S? Okay. No, this is a T. This is an S. The schwa is what you actually hear. It's the vowel. And we have the head right there. All the if you think about where the vowels are produced, and they're a little more distinct in German, and they're very distinct in Italian. That's why a lot of the great classics are written in Italian. Right, that's the where bel canto was developed. Italian has very pure vowels, and German has vowels that are more distinct than English, but they're somewhat more ambiguous. But if you look at where the different vowels are produced, and everyone can do this. Everyone say ah.
Ah.
And then say e.
E.
They're produced in different parts of the mouth, right? Right? E is sort of like more up here, and ah is sort of more in the back, right? And, yeah. And so if you just, and you have to actually do something with your tongue, right, and whatnot to produce this. But if you just relax and just sort of, you know, like wake up, right, that's a neutral position. Your tongue is just, that's why when you don't know what to say, you say, because that's the most thoughtless vowel. There's no thought. That's a schwa. And unfortunately, English is schwa dominated. There's a lot of, there's less us in German. And so, yeah, a schwa is simply an sound. Does that, if Ardina was here, would that answer her question?
Question.
Sure.
I was instructed to ask about the distinction between an ecologist and a geothermal physicist.
Yeah.
What do you call it?
Miwa?
Well, isn't ecology the study of like plants? I don't know what the study of ecology is actually. Oh, the ecosystem.
It's actually the study of.
Oh.
Well, I mean, from what I understand, it's like, you know, bio-geo, life, and the earth. How it's the study of how life is organizing the non-living, which is slightly different than, I mean, Jason might have something good to say, but that's slightly different than kind of having a removed conception of, like, this is the universe without man. Let's see it work. How does a natural ecology function? You know, it's all like. But when you have the biogeochemistry, you know, you have life as a physical principle, which is superior to non-living, organizing and creating non-living fossils, you know, and then you have noesis above that, you know, the noetic processes are organizing the subordinate too. It has dominion over them both, and that's really interesting. Hopefully what you got out of this is that hopefully we were able to blur that line, that distinction between science and art. You know, there is a certain scientific value in developing metaphors for these things. The way the human singing voice is able to use an abiotic atmosphere, the air, using its living vocal cords. I mean, the mind is the one generating the music, right? You choose to sing. You know what you're singing. But you do have to have a physical apparatus. It's interesting to see how the universe has given you everything you need to communicate ideas. So there must be something in that.
Anybody else?
If nobody has any questions, we're going to start the Musikabend.